A new corruption case against an Alaska businessman. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, the 11th of August. Good evening, I'm Laurie Townsend. Also tonight, Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne proposes changes to the Endangered Species Act. Environmental groups aren't happy.
These regulations would cut right to the heart of some of our most important protections for our nation's plants and animals. And the perfect example of that is what this would do to the polar bear.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
the Rasmussen Foundation, accepting applications from Alaska artists for project awards. The deadline is September 1st.
And by
the State of Alaska Department of Fish and Game. Information about the state's predator management program is available on the web at wildlife.alaska.gov.
State Senator John Cowdery pleaded not guilty to bribery and conspiracy charges in federal court today. He was indicted a month ago. APRN's Steve Heimel reports from the federal court building in Anchorage.
Flanked by his wife and daughter, Cowdery was rolled in a wheelchair into Judge John Roberts' courtroom by his attorney, Kevin Fitzgerald. He was read the two felony charges, and he pled not guilty to each. He's charged with conspiring with VCO executives Bill Allen and Rick Smith to give Senate Finance Committee member Donnie Olson of Nome $25,000 if he would support the oil tax change that VCO wanted in 2006. Olson has not been charged and cooperated with prosecutors. Cowdery's trial was set for October 6th before U.S. District Judge Ralph Beistlein. He was sent to the marshal's office for fingerprinting and released on $5,000 bail. Later in the day, a federal judge took up another corruption case, this one going back to 2004. Bill Weimer, the owner of Cornell Corrections, was due to plead out to charges that he paid $20,000 in campaign money to an unnamed legislative candidate and a political consultant during the primary election campaign 4 years ago. At the time, Weimer employed Frank Pruitt as his agent in Juneau. Pruitt testified against former state representative Tom Anderson, who was convicted in a bribery scheme that started around the same time. At the federal courthouse in Anchorage, I'm Steve Heimel.
The Bush administration is proposing changes to the Endangered Species Act, changes that would be the biggest revision in 20 years to the law that protects America's wildlife. The new regulations would cut out some of the reviews agencies have to undergo when they propose construction or development projects. The proposal also says it's not possible to link the emissions of greenhouse gases to impact on wildlife, and so that shouldn't be taken into account. The full details of the proposal will be released later this week, but Interior Department Secretary Dirk Kempthorne announced his plans today, calling them common sense changes. Kempthorne says the changes serve to update the Endangered Species Act, or ESA.
Our intent is to reduce the number of unnecessary consultations under the ESA. We need to focus our efforts where they will do the most good. It's important to use our time and resources to protect the most vulnerable species.
Kempthorne says it's not efficient to use limited resources to review actions where it's believed that endangered species won't be affected or potential effects are unlikely or remote. The Secretary of the Interior says the changes were inspired when the polar bear was listed as threatened under the Endangered Species Act in May. He says while the polar bear's habitat is shrinking, the Endangered Species Act is not the tool that should be used to set climate policy. Kempthorne says the Bush administration has acknowledged that climate change is a serious problem, but it believes the ways to address it is through Congress and international action, not the Endangered Species Act.
These regulations are consistent with the service's current understanding that it is not possible to draw a link between greenhouse gas emissions and distant observations of impacts affecting species.
Environmentalists blasted today's announcement, saying the changes would ruin the Endangered Species Act. The Center for Biological Diversity's Climate Program Director, Cassie Siegel, called the proposals destructive.
This is a
sneak attack on some of the most essential provisions of the Endangered Species Act. These regulations would cut right to the heart of some of our most important protections for our nation's plants and animals. And the perfect example of that is what this would do to the polar bear.
Siegel says the regulation would remove the ability of the Endangered Species Act to reduce greenhouse gas emissions, which she says are the biggest contributor to the warming that's shrinking the polar bear's sea ice habitat.
If this regulation had been in place when the bald eagle was listed under the act, we would never have been allowed to regulate DDT, and bald eagles would have gone extinct. By the same token, if this regulation were allowed to stand, it would lead to the extinction of the polar bear.
Siegel says the proposals are desired by industry and big business, and that Republicans in Congress have tried to push through similar changes, but they've been voted down. The Center for Biological Diversity and other environmental groups plan to weigh in on the proposals once they become public. A 30-day comment period will start once the proposal is released, which is expected to happen sometime this week. NovaGold Resources has been hit with a class action lawsuit over its mothballed Galore Creek mine in British Columbia and related statements it made during a takeover attempt by Barrick Gold Corporation. Paul Korchin from KNOM has more.
The suit was filed Thursday in New York's U.S. District Court by shareholder Rudolph Texter on behalf of all NovaGold stock purchasers between October 2006 and November 2007. NovaGold President and CEO Rick Van Nieuwenhuyse is one of three named defendants, along with Chief Financial Officer Don McDonald and Chief Operating Officer Peter Harris. The lawsuit contends NovaGold underestimated the capital expenses for getting Galore Creek online. The prospect holds at least 8.9 billion pounds of copper, 123 million ounces of silver, and 7.3 million ounces of gold. Last fall, Nova and partner Teck Kominco, which runs the Red Dog Mine near Kotzebue, boosted the estimated expenses from $2.2 billion to $5 billion. Plaintiffs claim the defendants falsely portrayed NovaGold as a rapidly growing company on the verge of moving from mid-tier exploration and development into production. The lawsuit contends such a portrayal was used by NovaGold to fend off a hostile takeover bid from Barrick. In November, NovaGold unexpectedly announced the suspension of the Galore Creek project in the face of those higher costs. That sent Nova's stock price tumbling by more than 70% and well below the $16 per share offered by Barrick. Nova's stock has still not recovered. It traded today at $6 and change per share, way off its high mark of nearly $22 last fall. NovaGold is working to get the Rock Creek prospect northwest of Nome online as its first producing mine, but increased expenses and stormwater runoff violations have hampered that. Nova also has a major stake in southwest Alaska's Donlin Creek prospect. Last week's lawsuit argues NovaGold executives failed to disclose materially adverse facts about the company's operations and prospects, thereby hurting shareholders. In a brief written statement issued Friday, NovaGold said it believes it has substantial legal and factual defenses, which it intends to pursue vigorously. In Nome, I'm Paul Korchin.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering Alaska Native leader Andrew John Hope.
Andy could have had a sense of entitlement, but what he had was a sense of responsibility.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the Alaska Engineering News Fund, whose contributors include Dowell Engineers, providing civil and transportation engineering, land surveying, and planning services on the web at dowell.com.
APRN will be providing special coverage of the 50th anniversary of Alaska statehood. For sponsorship information, call 550-8400.
There's still no sign of two Juneau men missing since Saturday on a flight from Young Lake on Admiralty Island. But today's weather has been better for an air search for State Deputy Revenue Commissioner Brian Andrews and his 24-year-old son, Brandon Andrews. They had been camping at Young Lake and had dropped off a family member and some gear late Saturday afternoon, then headed back to Admiralty in their Cessna 182 to pick up more gear. They never returned, and the search began Saturday evening. Over the weekend, rain and low-lying fog hampered the air search, so the Coast Guard cutter Liberty combed waters between Douglas and Admiralty Islands. The fog began to lift about mid-morning today. Coast Guard spokesman Levi Reed says three Coast Guard helicopters, as well as the Alaska National Guard and the Civil Air Patrol, have been searching about a 1,000-square-mile area west of Juneau. He says yesterday, rescue hikers joined the search.
Juneau Mountain Rescue hiked into where they were camping, and they found that the cabin was empty. So we were led to believe that they made the flight from Juneau back to Young Lake and picked up the rest of their camping gear that they had left behind. And from that point forth, we don't know where they went.
Meanwhile, two victims from a plane crash last night on northern Baranof Island have not yet been identified. The twin-engine Beechcraft Baron 55 reportedly left Gustavus with mechanical problems and low on fuel when it went down roughly 25 miles north of Sitka. A Coast Guard helicopter tracked a signal from an emergency locator transmitter to the crash site on Duffield Peninsula. The Government Accountability Office recently concluded a year-long study of mismanagement within the Indian Health Service. The investigation was spurred by complaints alleging IHS property was being misplaced or stolen at IHS headquarters and agency offices across the country. Although the GAO has the authority to conduct investigations on its own, two U.S. House committees asked for the audit. The Senate Indian Affairs Committee held a hearing on the findings of the report during the last week of July. Greg Coots is Managing Director of Forensic Audits and Special Investigations for the GAO. He says their investigation uncovered numerous lost or stolen items.
Those were laptops, PDAs or Blackberries, vehicles were stolen, and other mostly IT equipment was stolen. The evidence that we have, of course, no one will ever know how much of it is stolen versus lost. The types of items, again, most of what we looked at was information technology equipment. There were some items that were lost or ruined that were more medical equipment. And there were other items that were lost, such as large backhoes and caterpillars and things like that, which hopefully they were lost and not stolen. But because the records were so poor, no one probably will ever know.
Seems hard to lose a caterpillar.
It sure would be.
Do you have an idea of a total monetary amount that this represents?
Well, our number would be understated because you keep in mind that we did 100% inventory of IT equipment at headquarters, and we did sampling from seven field locations. There's 163 field locations. So with just the limited work we did, there was at least $15.8 million that IHS records indicated was lost or stolen over a four-year period. Plus, our statistical sampling and other physical testing showed additional amounts. But if you consider the fact that most locations did not do full physical inventories, and we did not do our inventory work at over 100 locations, the number is probably substantially higher.
And Mr. Coots, when you were looking at all these problems that were within IHS across the country, what stood out as the most egregious?
Well, I think some of the cases of waste we identified where an individual received a 23-inch, $1,700 computer monitor, and it was in shrink wrap in their office, and they had not ordered it, and it was just sitting there, complete waste of government resources. It was a very egregious example of waste. At the headquarters location, you had three computers on the books for every employee, yet at the same time, they were buying new computers, setting them in the corner because they had too many, and they were collecting dust. That would be probably the most egregious thing that I would have seen.
And how unusual is this, or isn't it? If you looked at other government agencies, do you think you'd find similar amounts of equipment lost or missing in some way? Or how unusual would you say this is?
We've identified agencies before that had lost or stolen property. There's been well-publicized cases of computers and other compromised government data that you've probably heard of before. But from a standpoint of the magnitude of the items that were lost or stolen, this would certainly be on the high end and probably worse than most of the other bad ones.
And so what have you recommended to Health and Human Services to strengthen their security at the Indian Health Service?
We issued 10 recommendations, and they agreed with 9 of them. And so most of them are really enforcing current policies rather than establishing new policies. On paper, many of the basic policies in place, such as requiring annual physical inventories and barcoding property, were not bad by design. The problem was people were not following them and no one was being held accountable. So if they certainly would implement the policies we're talking about and actually hold people accountable, this is not a real complex problem. It's real basic property management 101 type of issues.
Greg Kutz is the Director of Forensic Audits and Special Investigations for the Government Accountability Office. He says a follow-up report will be reported to Congress early next year. The status of dozens of computers stolen from the Delta Junction School remains uncertain. $100,000 worth of computers and other electronics are still in the hands of law enforcement agencies after being recovered from a student charged with breaking into the school in June. Delta Greeley School District Superintendent P.J. Ford Slack says it's not clear if the computers will make it back into the classroom.
That equipment was stored in a outside sort of fabricated shed somewhere in the woods. And so given the amount of water that we've all received this summer, we're not sure what shape the equipment is in. We think it's okay, but if and when it ever actually comes back, the insurance company has a clause where we would be able to purchase anything back at a nominal fee.
With the start of the new school year fast approaching, Ford Slack says the district has already tapped into reserve funding to replace some of the computers. She says insurance did not cover much of the cost of stolen equipment.
Depreciation on technology is fairly steep, plus there was a $10,000 deductible. So the district recouped $20,000 for $78,000 worth of equipment.
Ford Slack says it may be 2 weeks before the new computers show up. The superintendent says a committee is reviewing the security situation at the school, and the district is moving ahead with the expulsion process for the young man accused of the burglary. State and federal investigators cracked the case by tracking the stolen computers from an eBay listing back to Delta Junction. It's not clear if the 16-year-old was working alone, and the investigation continues.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the University of Alaska College Savings Plan, providing tax-advantaged college savings options for Alaska families. T. Rowe Price Investment Services Incorporated, distributor, underwriter. Information at 1-888-4, and then Alaska. And by
Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies throughout the U.S. and Canada. Grant Station, fast track to funding. On the web at grantstation.com.
Juneau's emergency energy crisis this spring resulted in a dramatic downturn in energy usage. Alaska Electric Light and Power in Juneau says its three major classes of customers, residential, commercial, and government, all cut their consumption by 20% or more. But the biggest energy savings occurred in people's homes, not at businesses or government offices. KTOO's John Ryan has the story.
Marcia Buck is a retired school administrator. She also knows her way around a chainsaw. She's got her electric chainsaw plugged into the side of her small home in the Mendenhall Valley.
Neighbors give me their scrap lumber, so I'm cutting the scrap lumber apart to use in my wood stove for the winter so I can heat more with wood and less with electricity.
Buck turned off her electric heat during Juneau's energy emergency by relying on her wood stove, turning off lights and power strips, and unplugging lots of appliances. She was able to cut her electricity use in half.
The front part of my house was always warm, using the wood stove, but my office area is in the back, so I wore a lot of clothes when I worked during the day in my office. Yeah, that was an imposition, to be cold while working.
AEL&P officials say it wasn't uncommon for Juneau households to cut their power consumption by 40 or 50%. When electricity prices shot up this spring, sales of energy-saving technologies did too. Things like water heater timers, newfangled light bulbs, and old-fashioned clotheslines. But Scott Willis with AEL&P says most of the community's energy savings came from new behaviors, not new technologies.
People were doing a lot of very inconvenient things. They knew that this was going to be a relatively short-term crisis, 1 or 2 or 3 months. And so they thought to themselves, I can do without baking in the oven for the next 3 months.
Willis says he expected power consumption to bounce back to normal in June. That's when the city's hydropower connection was restored and power prices fell back down to about the national average. Instead, demand has risen gradually. Juneau's power consumption remains about 10% below the levels of a year ago. That's despite an exceptionally cold and wet summer that has Juneau residents spending more time indoors this year. Some of the new habits imposed by skyrocketing prices seem to have taken hold. Sterling and Lindsay Salisbury cut their kilowatt hours by 75% in their month-to-month rental unit on Sunny Point. The young couple installed tiny LED lights throughout their home and turned off their heat entirely.
Well, we still conserve. I mean, even to this day, it's nowhere to the extreme of what we were with, like, the 45 degrees inside. But actually there towards the end, it was just the way of life. We got used to living like that, and it was kind of almost a change to have to go back.
Juneau's businesses and government offices also embraced conservation, but they didn't match residential customers' results. On the downtown waterfront, dock workers in bright orange overalls load freshly caught salmon and flounder off a conveyor belt. Fred Howard with Taku Smokeries and Fisheries fills a huge plastic bin with half a ton of freshly made ice. General Manager Eric Nelson says conservation options were limited when most of the company's electric bill goes to making 25 tons of ice a day to keep fish cold.
We did what we could and turned some lights down and things, but we got about 500 horsepower worth of engines and equipment's motors that chill the plant, make ice, and of course you can't do anything about that to compromise the quality of the fish.
At the Super Bear supermarket, assistant manager Mark Wharton says he couldn't cut back on refrigeration either. He did cut half the store's lights, but his customers put a stop to that conservation practice.
When the emergency was over, we left them off just to see how it would go, and the customers were turning the lights back up. Can't see everything, but they were willing during the, they understood during the crisis that it was a necessary step. But once we got out of that, let's turn the lights back on so we can see everything. We've still got some lights on the perimeter that we didn't turn back on.
Alan Meyer with the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory in California says there are lots of things people can do to reduce their energy use without compromising the things that they use energy for. But adopting energy-efficient technologies is usually a bit more complicated than flipping off a light switch.
I don't think people were able to make any significant investments in efficiency improvement in that short period. The price went down. There wasn't a real program to continue with replacing behavioral changes with more efficient technologies. So it's not surprising that energy consumption returned close to its original level.
Meyer says the big lesson of Juneau's accidental experiment in conservation is that changing Americans' energy habits is possible.
You know, we shouldn't be quite so gloomy if we really want to save energy. Yeah, it can happen, but it's not going to be pure technology. It will involve the changes in behavior, too.
Juneau Mayor Bruce Patello has created a special commission to come up with other lessons the capital city might learn from its energy emergency. The Lessons Learned Commission holds a public hearing in City Hall on August 20th. In Juneau, I'm John Ryan.
Funeral services were held today for Alaska Native leader Andrew John Hope III at St. Michael's Orthodox Cathedral in Sitka. Hope died Thursday after a brief battle with cancer. He was 58 years old. A traditional Tlingit ceremony and an Alaska Native Brotherhood memorial were held over the weekend for the man many people describe as a warrior for his people. Hope was born in Sitka and lived in Juneau for many years. KTOO's Rosemary Alexander has more on his life and cultural contributions.
Dartmouth College professor and anthropologist Sergei Kahn first met Andy Hope in 1979 on a research trip to Sitka. Kahn had emigrated to America from Russia and was studying the role of the Russian Orthodox Church in Southeast Alaska Tlingit communities.
When I first came to Sitka, some of the older establishment non-native people in town still referred to Andy as that hippie radical. They said, oh, that radical Andy.
At that time, Hope was administrator of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. His studies at the University of California, Berkeley probably helped him earn that 1970s handle.
He was just as interested in Tlingit history and culture as in jazz and modern American poetry.
Hope's friends and family now refer to him as a tradition bearer, an artist, poet, author, and scholar who was passionate about his Tlingit culture and was a leading advocate for Alaska Native education. Son Ishmael Hope says there was a strong literary aspect to all of his father's work, whether it was in Tlingit politics, for the Sitka tribe, or education.
I think it's very significant that my father moved on to education after challenges and tribulations and difficulties with working in the very unique Native political community. You know, when he stopped being able to be truly effective in the political community, he really turned to education.
Hope's degrees came from the University of Alaska Fairbanks, the latest earned in 2005, a Master of Arts in Cross-Cultural Studies. Lifelong friend Peter Metcalf of Juneau says Hope's passion for learning led him to work with school districts to help make the educational system more accommodating to Alaska Natives. He continually advocated that Natives pursue academic degrees. Metcalf collaborated with Hope on several projects, including a map of the names, clans, and clan houses of the Tlingit Nation. Hope began collecting information for it in the 1970s, recording interviews with elders over a period of 20 years. Metcalf came late into the project to help him publish it. He says the Tlingit tribal map may be one of Hope's most important publications. His most enduring legacy is the Sharing Our Knowledge Tlingit Clan Conference. Several have been held since it was first organized in 1993. Last year, more than 500 scholars and linguists from around the world joined Tlingit artists and historians in Sitka. The next one is scheduled for Juneau in March.
It's becoming a premier event for the study of Alaska Northwest Coast Natives.
Metcalf calls Andrew Hope III a high-born Tlingit. His family had major roles in Alaska history. His grandfather was a legislator, his father an early director of the Sea Alaska Corporation, and both were presidents of the Grand Camp of the Alaska Native Brotherhood.
Andy could have had a sense of entitlement, but what he had was a sense of responsibility.
Family and friends say Hope quietly fulfilled that sense of responsibility, letting others take the credit. Dartmouth Professor Kahn is one of several anthropologists who has worked with Hope over the years on a number of scholarly endeavors, including the Clan conferences. He calls Andy Hope a bridge to cultural preservation.
If I can place him in terms of generations, he was a really perfect kind of link between the older generation, like his grandfather, Andy Hope I, and the other elders whom he knew when he was growing up in the 50s and 60s, and the younger generation of his son and the younger people. And being in that position, he had absorbed the knowledge of the older people, and he was able to pass it on to the younger generation.
In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. We had reports tonight from Paul Korchin in Nome, Rosemarie Alexander and John Ryan in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Steve Heimel from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Our intern is Eli Menneker. John Prophet is our webmaster. Our managing editor is Duncan Moon. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, operating and maintaining the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, and by Wells Fargo, a proud supporter of cultural activities that enrich the lives of all Alaskans. Wells Fargo, the next stage. APRN would like to thank BP for sponsoring Alaska Morning News and Alaska News Nightly. To learn more about this sponsorship, call 907-550-8400.
Harvesting wild game is extremely important to many Alaskans, not only as a food source, but as a long-standing traditional practice. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game is committed to maintaining healthy caribou and moose populations. To learn more about the principles and guidelines behind predator management, visit wildlife.alaska.gov or contact your local fish and game office. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska, Department of Fish and Game.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.